If you have your Bibles this morning, turn to Exodus chapter 16. Exodus chapter 16. Thanks, Brian and worship team. It's good to worship together. So we are a week, I don't know, three, four, something like that, into this series about the wilderness experience of Israel and about our own wilderness experiences. And so one of the working convictions that I have as we talk about these things is that each of us go through not only one, but probably a series of wilderness experiences over the course of our life. And so if we all experience them, it's important for us to know what to pay attention to and what these experiences are supposed to or can do in our lives. And so that's why we're in the midst of this series. So there's three ways, and I just want to reiterate that wilderness comes about for each one of us. One, it can be a God-induced sort of thing where God can send you or send me into a wilderness experience. That can be one thing, but it's not necessarily every way that it happens. We can also get sent into the wilderness because of ourselves, choices that we make or thoughts that we have that propel us in a certain direction to make certain decisions. So we can send, because of our own decisions, we can send ourselves into a period of wilderness. The last thing, and there might be more than this, but I think this kind of summarizes or maybe the totality of it all. But we can get sent into the wilderness by the experiences that other people and the decisions that other people make that have implications on us. And so the decisions, none of our decisions are ever made in isolation. They're always made in the context of relationships. A decision that you make doesn't just impact you, it impacts the people around you. And sometimes we are sent into the wilderness because of the decisions that people make around us. Okay, so today what we want to look at is what the wilderness experience invites us to pay attention to. So if we're wondering, you know, and there's sirens, isn't there? Okay, I have a confession. I'm just kidding. They're not coming for me. They might be coming for the two dogs that were stranded outside. We did call the police this morning for them. I digress. Anyway, what we want to do this morning is pay attention to what the wilderness is inviting us to pay attention to. And so sometimes we put the picture up on the screen the last couple weeks. The wilderness looks vast, and it's almost, and we'll see this morning, once you cross one desert, sometimes you hit another desert, and you think you're about through, but then you crest that hill, and it's just another desert. And so sometimes it doesn't feel like we're making any progress. It seems like we're doing the same thing over and over again. And so if progress isn't coming in a measurable kind of way, what are some of the things that we can be paying attention to that God can use the wilderness experience to teach us? And so that's what we want to look at this morning. We're going to look at three simple verses, and then we'll look at one verse to close, but it's Exodus 16, verses 1 through 3. So let me just remind us where we've been. So we've had the experience of the Exodus where Israel has walked through the Red Sea, piles of water on both sides, ground is dry. They make it through the other side. They are free. Their oppressors are drowned in the ocean or in the sea behind them, and Moses and Miriam both sing this wonderful song to the Lord for what he has done. And then last week we looked at this incident that happens immediately following. So 3 days after you move through this Red Sea, you have this bickering towards the Lord, this non-trust towards God when they're thirsty and they don't have any water. And so they're complaining to God about it. And God just gives them, he has Moses throw a piece of wood in the bitter water and it's made sweet. They can drink. They've just had this miraculous experience, and this is the next verses that we read. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. Desert of Sin is not like sin, it's short for Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month, after they had come out of Egypt. So we're less than 3 months after the walls of water. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out here into this desert to starve the entire assembly to death." God's just provided water. God's just made mounds of water. Their tummies are rumbling. It doesn't even say that they don't have food. It just says that, oh, man, back in the day, we really had the Brazilian steakhouse of Egypt. The Bible's first account of what I think is a God-ordained thing, the Brazilian steakhouse. If you've never been to one, I'd be happy to go with you. So what do these three simple verses, because there's things that I think we're invited, Israel's being invited to pay attention to here, and it's only three verses, but you can pull out some incredible truths here about what God is inviting us to pay attention to in the wilderness. And so the first one is this. The first thing that we're invited to pay attention to is our understanding of who God is. So let's look at verses 2 and 3. It'll be on the screen behind me, or you can look in your Bibles as well. It says, "In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, 'If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt.'" And so there's a couple interesting things that happen here. One, they identify the presence of God not with just having given them water, not just putting the walls of the Red Sea up, but they identify God being back in Egypt. Okay, so God is not present, but God is distant. And they remember God in a punishing sort of way. So their idea of God is a God who has punished the Egyptians. Remember last week, one of the things that the wilderness does is we said that it works the Egypt out of us. And so they're still identifying with Egypt. They haven't moved on to understand God in a new way as a God who provides, as a God who rescues. But they're still under this old framework of God that is actually more based upon what the Egyptians believed about the gods than it is about how God is revealing himself. So one of the bottom line things that we can learn as we're looking at Israel here is that sometimes when we're in a desert experience, we allow our situation to act as the lens that we see God through rather than God's revelation of how God is revealing himself in the wilderness. Let me repeat that. Sometimes we can see God and understand who God is through looking at through the lens of our situation, rather than allowing God to define God's self through the lens of God's revelation. Now, for Israel, they have an option here in the place in this predicament that they're in. They have an option. They can allow their situation to determine their view of God, and this is what is happening. Their situation is shaping their view and their understanding of who God is. Contrary to how God has revealed himself over in just the span of several months. So the invitation for you and I is to kind of settle down into this experience of wilderness and be attentive to how is God revealing himself here. How is God revealing himself here? Because God does reveal himself in the wilderness. I think this is one of the purposes of the wilderness, is everything else is stripped away. Everything that you thought you knew, all the formulas that you thought worked before, all the stuff, even if it was good and it did work before, just doesn't seem to be working again. But that doesn't mean that God has changed necessarily. It might mean that God is shifting your perspective. God is enlarging your understanding and experience of who God is. So it's not that God is not present. God is stripping away the things in the wilderness in order to reveal something new about who he is. Now, just an aside, so to speak, for us as we think about one another, as we think about the church. There are some of us who have gone through wilderness experiences who can attest to this in the past, to God's faithfulness and things in the past, who have come about on the other side of it. Then there are some of us in the church, in this community, who are still in the midst of a wilderness experience. To those who have gone through, the best thing that you can do for those who are in it is not to try to get them through it. Let me repeat that. If you have gone through a wilderness experience, you've come out the other side, you've learned wonderful, amazing things about God, that experience is not going to be somebody else's experience. And so you don't want to try to give them the formula that worked for you. You might be able to share that story, but don't expect it to be replicated. The best thing that we can do for one another as a community of faith, as we go through the wilderness, is to join with one another, to join with those who are going in through the wilderness experience, and to be present with them in the wilderness. Not to give easy answers, not to give the formulas that worked for you, but to help them pay attention to how God is revealing himself to the people in the midst of the wilderness. One of the things that we don't want to do, I mean, we do want to do it, but we don't want to do it because it's working against the wilderness experience. We don't want to rush the wilderness. Because the wilderness is not about our timing, it's about God's work. And our timing usually is a lot faster than God's work. Your formation takes a lot longer than you think it does. It requires the investment, not only of you investing time, but it takes time for things to sink in. This is why in the beginning of this wilderness experience, it's very important to understand that we might even think of Israel as a baby or a toddler at this point in time in their story. They're not teenagers. They're teenagers like maybe in numbers. Right now, they're babies, and they're being fed baby food. They can't feed themselves, and so God's taking care of them. God's being super gracious to them. That's the point that we are in the story. Now, over time, the story will develop, and God wants his children to develop and mature in their understanding of who he is, in their obedience to God. But right now, they're being coddled, and it's okay. It's okay. And so one of the things that we can do as we're in the wilderness experience, well, two things. One, we can pay attention to how God reveals himself. Rather than being defined by the situation, this is going back to last week, it's an issue of trust. So it's either saying, I'm going to view God through this lens of my situation, and this is going to define who God is, or because I know who God is, I'm going to see this situation differently, and I'm going to trust God with this situation. So the lens becomes how God reveals himself, not by my situation. So that's one of the first things that's reshaped in the desert, is our understanding of who God is. And even if you know, because many of us here have been either in the church or around faith for a long period of time. Many of you know who God is, but you don't know, none of us know all of who God is. So don't presume that God doesn't have something new to show you about who God is. Secondly, we see our past in a different way. So not only is our understanding of who God is reshaped in the wilderness experience, but we begin to understand the past in a different way. If we look at verse 3, it says, "The Israelites said to them, 'If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt, there we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food that we wanted.'" George Williams says, "The wilderness is not only geographical but psychological. It can be a state of mind as well as a state of nature. And one of the things that happens in the wilderness is that we idealize the past. And in idealizing the past, it keeps us from trusting God in the present." The truth of the matter is, as my mom likes to say, the truth of the matter is they probably were on a diet of basically vegetables. Pots of meat, not a reality. Anytime they wanted to eat, not a reality. They were an enslaved people. And so they're looking at this past through these rose-colored glasses, but what that is doing is keeping them from trusting God in the present. So why is it that we do this? I mean, I think all of us do this to one degree or another. We idealize the past. So when I dream of home, I have weird dreams. My subconscious, you know, Freud or Jung or whoever would have had just a number with me. If dreams express subconscious, mine are very interesting. I always have dreams about people wanting to kill me. although it hasn't been any of you yet, so it's okay. But when I dream of home, it's interesting. I don't dream of 3741 Nolt Road where I grew up as a child. I don't dream of 1 Hemlock Drive or 28 Breezeway where I was, or 608 Julia Avenue where we were in Canada. When I dream of home, oddly enough, I dream of 4009 Green Street. This house by far was the worst one we ever lived in. When we moved in, the whole thing needed renoed, gutted. The basement flooded every rain. And not only flood, but the water was kind enough to flow through the electrical panel every time. It's like, why am I idealizing this house? Well, there's probably some reasons to it. It's the house where our family kind of grew up in. Connor was about maybe 18 months or so when we moved into there, and then we subsequently had Chloe and Christian there, so our family grew there. We added Ella, our dog. So there's all these things that happened there. But to idealize that place is just interesting to me because it wasn't a great house. I couldn't bathe my kids in their bathroom because the water would leak through the ceiling and then it would damage our floor and the ceiling in the dining room. Actually, it was the room that we never knew what to name because we didn't know what to use it for. It was like this pass-through. Anyway, why do we idealize these things? I don't know. But I think one of the things that we see with Israel, and when we see idealism of the past, is it keeps us from trusting God in the present, because living in the present is more difficult than dreaming of how good the past was or wasn't. The present requires us to press in a different way, to kind of press on in a different way than the past does. Present is reality. The past has happened, it's formed us, it's shaped us, but it's amazing how we can idealize that past and keep us from taking responsibility of what we need to do in the present. There's two ways, I think, that we can idealize the past, and one is what Israel is doing here. They call the past good when it was bad. And so we remember through rose-colored glasses, oh man, you remember when this was just great, when it really wasn't, because you just don't want to deal with what's in front of you. Sometimes that happens for us. I thought about it, though. Sometimes we idealize the past, too, when the good is good. It's not just when the things were bad and we remember them as good. Sometimes things were good, and because we remember them as so good, we still get stuck in the past because we want to go back to that time when things were just simply good. And it prevents us from pressing into the present and growing through the situations that are in front of us now, through the desert and wilderness experiences that are in front of us now. One of the ways to illustrate, I thought about illustrating this, was just through my own faith experiences from maybe 19 to 21 till maybe, I'm 41 now, so the last couple years. So I can look back at my ages of 19 through 21, being in college, and I could idealize that because I'm not only saying it was good, it was really good. I was in an environment that was kind of a Christian bubble. I was on a Christian campus. It was really great for building a foundation of faith. I had a whole bunch of people who were passionate about Jesus. I learned to pray there. I learned to worship there. I learned basic leadership principles there. There were so many things that were so good about that time. But 41-year-old me does not need the spirituality of 21-year-old me. Because as good as that was, it was also like, woo, I'm close to God if I feel God. I'm awful and whatever if I don't feel God, don't feel God. Oh, man, that's tiring. 41-year-old me needs a more stable faith. But what happened in those years, the experiences of God that I had in those years were super nurturing to me. And so I don't want to say that those were bad or those weren't good. Those were good, but those were good for a time. And if we don't move past the goodness for what God had for us in that time, it actually works against what God wants to do now. You can't live in the past goodness and grace, because if you try to take that grace into the present moment, it might not be the grace that you need for the present moment. Because you've grown, you've changed, your situations have changed, your environments have changed, you've learned things, and God, I guarantee, probably has something new to teach you. And so we don't want to take the good of the past and just expect that good to work formulaically for the present. We're thankful for those things. They've built something in us. They've done something in us. But God has something for us now. And if we idealize the past, we might miss what God has for us in the present. Lastly, this is kind of a hard one of the three, I think. The wilderness invites us to learn to take responsibility for ourselves. The wilderness is a space where we learn and we begin to take personal responsibility for ourselves. So verse 3b, the second half of verse 3, says, "But you have brought us out into this desert," and they're speaking to Moses at this point. So I'll just read the whole sentence. "There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted," idealism. "But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." What's interesting here, Moses is their leader, but Moses is God's representative, but Moses is not God. And so it's interesting to me that the people don't address God, they address Moses. And you kind of get there's this blame that's taking place there. And something that we can take away from this, I think, is that blaming someone else, blaming a Moses, putting the blame on somebody else is easier than dealing with God. Because whenever we have to deal with God, we have to deal with ourselves. It's so much easier for us to scapegoat and say, because this person, blah, blah, blah. It's easier for us, instead of saying, God, why is this going on? We blame somebody else for it, because then we don't have to deal with God. Because when we deal with God, there's an element of weight and truthfulness that comes with that that we don't necessarily experience when we're trying to scapegoat our way out of something. Two thoughts on how we avoid dealing with God. This isn't necessarily in the text, but it is a way that we avoid dealing with God. We simply just talk to each other. So, at the best, the church is a place where we can support one another, where we can, kind of in that story of Moses that'll come later on, be the Aaron and the Hur, and continue to keep Moses' arms lifted up in the midst of the battle that he's facing. At the best, the church can be that. But sometimes the church can also be a crutch when we're advice-seeking or we're venting or we're doing something about something that's going on in our life, and we're doing that with one another, and it's in the context of Christian community, but it never takes the next step of actually dealing with God. What I found is this, is that we're pretty, we kind of tell each other what we want to hear. Oh, yeah, that is hard. Oh, you know, it's kind of, you know, we're just super kind to each other. And in instances when we're truth-telling, sometimes that person never comes back to us again, because that's not exactly what we wanted. We don't want the truth, we just want comfort. But one of the things that the wilderness experience does is I think it strips the comforts and forces us, invites us to deal with truth. It forces us to deal with God. And dealing with God is quite something, because as much as I can pull the wool over my friend's eyes, I can't do that with God. And so that's kind of why I go to my friends rather than I go to God. Because it's a lot easier to fool them than it is to fool God. Well, one of the things that the wilderness experience, I think, invites us to do is to deal with God. And as we close here, we'll have just a very vivid picture of the God that we're dealing with. And I think it makes it a little less intimidating, perhaps. But in the wilderness, it's an invitation to deal with God, because in dealing with God, we're going to get to know who God is. But one of the things that keeps us from dealing with God is not only seeking out the advice of others, but it's living this life of blame where we're not taking personal responsibility. Now, I need to just, if I could push pause for a second, because we need to nuance this a little bit. There are things that happen to people, and I especially think of those of you who might have suffered abuse and those kinds of things. This is a whole other category than what I'm talking about now. So I'm not saying take responsibility for it, get over it, you know, work your way through it. That's nothing that I'm talking about here, okay? Those things need to be called what they are. They're injustice, they're oppressive, they're evil if you've been suffering at the hands of those things. That's in a separate category than what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is the times when we look at the people who are leading us and we say, because we don't want to take personal responsibility for our own spirituality, we say, you've done this to me. Or a common phrase that every pastor hears, you're just not feeding me. Sorry, I'm giving you the pastoral eye roll because for me, that's malarkey. Learn to eat. Sorry. It's freeing to be able to say these things to you and not, you know, have any issues in the background. So pastors are now laughing. But I'll speak from my own experience. So in my leadership experience, one of the things that my leadership history, this is the first time I have been the buck stops here leader. I've never had that experience before. I've had to serve under leaders and sometimes under large systems of leaders before. And in almost every case, I have experienced some wound of some leader somewhere. There's not been an environment where I didn't have an ouch experience. Even in the most healthy environment that I've had, there's been some ouches that have happened to me. It would be very easy, and I tell you what, it's been maybe 10, 12 years since like some of the major ones have happened to me. But at that time, I was like, man, it is their fault. This is, you know, what's happening to me is their issue, it's their problem, they don't know how to lead, blah, 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 blah. And I scapegoated my own responsibility because I didn't want to face the Egypt inside of me. And sometimes we do that, not only, and it doesn't have to be a pastor leader, it can be a boss leader, frankly, it can be a national leader. It can be local leaders. But we can scapegoat taking responsibility for the things that we need to take responsibility for because somebody is failing in leadership. And we see this happening in the life of Israel. Rather than taking responsibility for what God is calling them to do and how God is calling them to grow and how God is calling them to be, they say, this is your fault, Moses. And sometimes that happens. All that to say, when we're in the desert experience, when we're in the wilderness experience, when things aren't going well, it's not an opportunity to blame. It's an opportunity to look within and to take responsibility for your own self. That's how you grow. Parentally speaking, in a spiritual way, like that's good parenting. You need to learn to take responsibility for yourself and for your own actions and how you're going to respond to things. Because none of us live in an ideal environment. None of us live in a place where all of our responses are going to be, man, this is great, this is awesome. Never. We're always going to live, whether it's at home, raising kids, in marriage, at work, financially speaking, we're always going to, just being a member of global humanity, we're always going to live in a place where things are far less than perfect, and we have to take responsibility and learn how to respond in a way that honors Jesus, in a way that Jesus would respond. And those things have to be developed and formed and shaped in us, and this is part of, I think, the opportunity of a wilderness experience. To sum all that up, Gene Edwards writes this fantastic little book. And if you have ever, anybody in here, has ever experienced pain at the hands of Christian leaders, okay, if any of you has ever experienced pain at the hand of a Christian leader, I would encourage you to read Gene Edwards' book, The Tale of Three Kings. Super small book. You can probably read it in about an hour and a half. But it's this story about King David and King Saul and how God is using Saul in David's life. So it's a fictional account, but it's imaginative, and for me, it was super, super healing. But this is what Edwards writes in one of these moments that's describing Saul and David. He says to David, "You have your eyes on the wrong King Saul." And if you don't know the story of King Saul and King David, King Saul, before David becomes king, is trying to kill him, basically. He's throwing spears at him, plotting against him, whatever. "You have your eyes on the wrong King Saul. As long as you look at your king, you will blame him and him alone for your present hell. But be careful, for God has his eyes fastened sharply on another King Saul. Not the visible one standing up there throwing spears at you. No, God is looking at another King Saul, one just as bad or worse. God is looking at the King Saul in you." So many times, and I would just, maybe this is a principle for us to use. If we're in a place of blaming someone or something, my alternative question for you would be, what responsibility now is yours? You might not change the other person, you might not change the environment, but how are you going to respond? Because that is going to form and shape your own soul, your own life, and that will have an impact on the world around you. So if you're tempted to blame, if you're tempted to scapegoat, begin to ask yourself the question, what responsibility is mine here? Okay. That was like the part. But here's the cool part. Now I'll ask Brian and the worship team to come up. Now, because we talked about reshaping our understanding of who God is, we see the past in a different way. We learn to take responsibility. All these things happen under the care of a God who reveals himself in a particular way. And so after the walls of water, after doing these amazing things for them, after freeing them, after destroying their oppressors, after responding to them, through their in their bickering because the water tasted bad and it wasn't drinkable, and God makes it sweet again, he responds to this desire for meat and this idealizing of the past, in this misunderstanding of who God is, in this blaming and scapegoating Moses. This is how God responds. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'I will rain down bread from heaven for you.'" That's all the further I want to go. We'll pick up with manna and quail next week. But think about this. Griping, complaining, moaning, non-trusting, all of these things, this is how God responds. "I'm going to rain down bread for you." So we're going to get towards communion here in a minute. And bread is rained down every week for us to receive. We need to remember that God is a God who rains down bread. So it doesn't matter the shortcomings that we have. God is just so patient to teach us. But we also have to take our responsibility to learn. He's not going to do it for us. He's going to do it with us. God is going to form and shape us with our cooperation. This is how we grow. This is how we mature. This is how we deepen our lives in the life of God. But he rains down bread for us every week. He doesn't grow tired and weary of giving us bread, of giving us wine, of giving us sustenance, of giving us joy and life. These are two things that those represent. That's the God that is before us constantly. This is the God that we worship. So all these things, all these testings of the desert fall between, remember week one, two promises. They are promises that God makes to us. God is a covenantal God. God will not leave us based upon whether we pass or fail the tests of the wilderness. God remains with us because that's who God is. So let's stand, let's sing, and then we'll take communion together. Amen.